now. It's the actual. I love this moment that when Sylvia comes in, because this month I'm just going to have a look in my bag. Sylvia Kent is here with the book club, and today I've got whiskey marmalade.
Bribery.
Every time I've had lovely chutneys. I've had jam. Mm. I've had what's it? The cucumbers or the courgettes?
Courgettes,
which were lovely. Yeah. So I'm very lucky.
It's my hobby.
And cakes as well.
My hobby.
Yeah. I wish I'd lived with you. That'd be better. And now Sylvia Kent is here with the book club. As you know, Sylvia comes in once a month with a guest writer as well. Just to give you a little bit of an update on who Sylvia is. Sylvia is a fantastic writer. She also has 9 books of her own as well. You can check her out on the Blogspot, which is sylviakent.blogspot.co.uk. She's a writer, author, columnist for national, regional magazines and online journals. As I said, she's a writer of 9 books, including The Woman Writer, Essex Folklore, Brentwood Historic Town, and Mary's Magdalene Billericay, to name but
their local history. Local history.
Absolutely.
Except Joyce Grenfell, of course.
Yes.
Yes, that's a national, yes.
And we're also joined by your guest as well as my guest today in the studio. And we've got Brian Davis. Now, Brian has written a fantastic book, which we're going to be talking to you in a little while, Brian. Just going to have a quick chat with Sylvia first. So, Billericay Reading Group, what are you guys up to at the moment?
Oh, the Billericay readers. My goodness. Well, they're reading the books they were given over Christmas, so they haven't really paid that much attention to our list. But as you know, we have some wonderful books that are researched for us from Essex Libraries. And you heard about Huckleberry Finn, and you heard about The Long Song, I think, last time, Andrea Levy, who wrote Small Island. That's a fantastic book. The book I'm reading at the moment is set very close to this place because it's called Lady Audley's Secret. Mm-hmm. And the person who recommended that was our own Lord Peter, who was at Ingatestone Hall. The book is set against Ingatestone Hall. And it really is amazing because it was written 150 years ago. Oh. It's quite exciting. It's about Victorian life and the naughty things that went on. So Lord Peter said, read it before you do my article. I'm just about to do an article about Ingatestone Hall.
Yeah.
But it really is exciting. And bearing in mind how old it is, it was written by Mary Elizabeth Braddon, who was very famous at the time. And that's what we're all reading in Billericay Readers Group.
Is it such an old book? Is it quite difficult to get through? Is it quite an easy read, or is it quite...
Very easy.
Very easy.
Penguin is the company that produced these books, this series, and it's never been out of print.
Yeah.
Wish I could say that. Well, no, most of mine are in. But
you've got a third edition. You were saying you've got a third edition of one of your books out at the moment.
Yes, on the Billericay Voices. Where
so third edition, it means it's been published and
again.
Yeah.
And you get royalties, you know. Brian will know all about royalties, I'm sure. They're little things that come from time to time to show that people are reading your book.
Yeah. Hi, I'm still joined in the studio with this month's book club by Sylvia Kent and today's guest writer, Brian Davis. Hello, Brian. You can say hello.
Hello.
That's good.
Hello, everybody. Otherwise,
people won't think you're there.
Yeah, I'm still awake.
Still there. Now, we're just going to have a little chat with you, Brian. We will be coming back and chatting some more. Now, you've got a book out at the moment. Actually, I wanted to talk about your background a little bit because you were a newspaper reporter, which I can imagine if going back to you, it was in the 1960s that you actually started out in that job.
1951, believe it or not.
So, we're so used to today with our computers. Must have been incredibly hard work because you would have used a manual typewriter probably to do up all the stories in notepads.
Absolutely. And the printing was done by printers using movable type, which seems an age ago now.
And how did you? What did you always want to get into being a reporter, or were you more into creative writing? How did you get into being a journalist?
No, I thought journalism was the job to be in. What encouraged me was that when I was at school, someone who left just before me became a newspaper reporter, and I used to see him chugging around the country on a little motorised bicycle, and I thought this is fantastic. It's the motorised bicycle that appealed to me, so I decided I'd be a journalist, and it all grew from there.
Was it quite cutthroat back in those days, or did, because you see the press now, and you just see they seem to be very hounding people, and they take pictures. Was it a little bit more civilised back in the 50s and 60s?
I think probably it was, yes. I mean, I spent most of my time cycling around the Dorset countryside, chasing fire engines, and doing the hatches, matches and dispatches.
Did you used to take pictures? Did you do the whole thing? So you would take the pictures and then write the article?
The photographers were a completely different breed, and the reporters just asked them to come along and do what they did and go back to the office.
And what was your biggest story that you broke? Do you remember?
I don't know about the biggest story. One amusing story was when I thought I had a real scoop. I'd only been in journalism, I think, probably about 3 or 4 months. I thought I had a real scoop because I was asked to go and interview someone who was celebrating their golden wedding. So I cycled about 5 miles to this house, knocked on the door, a lady came to the door, and I said, "Hello, I'm from the local paper. I'd like to write something about your golden wedding." To which she looked at me and she said, "Young man, do I look as if I've been married 50 years? It's my mother you want." That was my scoop.
Now, you were also, before we talk about the book, you were also the sub-editor at the Guardian newspaper as well.
I was a sub on the Guardian for a couple of years.
So tell us what that actually means, because I'm not sort of, I don't really know that much about newspapers. What sort of job and what did you used to do?
As a sub-editor, the copy had been written by the reporters and used to come onto the news desk, and the sub-editors would look at it and make sure there was nothing wrong. It was written in good journalese, no obvious mistakes. I did make one big faux pas once because Alastair Cook was writing for The Guardian at the time, and I didn't like way he'd written his copy, so I changed it, and I was told in no uncertain terms that no one messes about with Alastair Cook's copy.
Letter from America.
That's right.
And you would have done all this manually. This wasn't on computer at the time. This was all be done sort of manually.
Everything was done manually at the time, yes, of course.
I remember the times before computers and using a manual typewriter, and I was just dreadful. Yeah. Except that little correction stuff used to be all over my bits of paper.
Certainly times have changed.
And Brian, when did you actually start writing stories? When did you kind of get into creative writing?
Well, after I retired, I had about 40 years in journalism. When I retired, I needed a hobby, needed something to keep my brain going, and I thought I could perhaps write a book. Well, now, there's no novel in me. I know I wouldn't be able to write a novel. So I thought I'd have to write something, some non-fiction. Enter my wife. She said, "Why don't you write about national service?" She said, "You spent 2 years hating it and 50 years saying how wonderful it was." So she said, "Why don't you write about national service?"
Yep.
And so I contacted as many former national servicemen as I could find, people that I'd served with, and I've got 75 of them to write their experiences, what they thought about national service and the experiences they had. And they were very variable. Some had a wonderful time, went to places like Jamaica, Paris. Others had a terrible time. A lot of my intake, a lot of my colleagues went to Kenya to fight the Mau Mau, which wasn't fun. And many others went to Korea from the same intake. But after I finished my basic training, they realised I could type, and they said, "Right, Davis, you stay in this country, and you go up to the orderly room, and you're going to be a clerk."
Yeah.
So I stayed in Exeter for 2 years. Well, my friends went off to Kenya to fight the Mau Mau. So I was pretty happy with that.
About the same as what happened to my dad, actually.
He
didn't get to go abroad.
Yes, if you could type. Yeah. I think I exaggerated my ability at shorthand to a certain extent, but I got by. I know that every time the sergeant said, "The adjutant wants you in the office with your shorthand notebook, Davis," I wondered if that's when I was going to be rumbled. But with a bit of basic shorthand and some very fast longhand, I managed to keep my job for 2 whole years.
Now, I'm joined in the studio with this month's book club with Sylvia Kent and Brian Davis, who is our guest writer. We're just speaking to Brian just before the break. Just going to come back quickly to the lovely Sylvia, who sat there looking beautiful as per usual.
Aww.
It's very, very nice. Now, the book festival.
Yes.
When is that? Is that it's coming
launching
again.
Launching in March.
Okay,
March
and what, who have we got this time? Because we have a lot of the guest writers come along and they kind of go through their books. And
yes.
I think last year was about 20 or so writers. 70?
Yeah.
Was it 70, really?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. But some weren't that well known, so you tend to think about those. Like this year, we've got Anne Widdecombe.
Oh, yeah. Like
Terry Waite.
Yep.
Michael Dobbs.
I thought you were going to say Michael Douglas. I was trying to jump up.
No. Gervaise Finn. Gervaise Finn is fantastic.
Okay.
But people really need to look at the guide, which they can do online. It's easy, easy peasy.
So that's what do they need to type in?
Well, they go into www.essexbookfestival.org.uk, and you'll see amazing people. We've got Henry Blofeld.
Ooh.
Now, I'm sure that my friend here remembers Henry Blofeld.
Indeed. Yes.
And he's going to be at Colchester at Leia Marney Tower. So that should be a very good one. And his book is called Squeezing the Orange.
Oh, okay.
Now, I've given him an ad, haven't I?
Yes, you have.
I grew up in Ferndown in Dorset during the war, and many of my playmates, in fact, were evacuees from Southampton.
Yeah.
Most of the children from Southampton were distributed around the country, and many came to our village. And after I'd done the National Service book, I sort of realised that both National Service and the evacuation, soon anyone involved with that, they won't be here anymore. They're dying out. And I felt that both National Service and the evacuation should be recorded before it's all forgotten. There have, in fact, of course, been many books about both National Service and evacuation.
Yeah.
But I wanted to do a book which would have the impact of it being written by the evacuees in their own words, rather than just a précis or a summing up of what evacuation was like.
Yeah.
I thought it would have a lot more impact if it was in the words of the people involved, and not try to be clever and turn their experiences into wonderful English.
Yes.
Let them tell it in their own words. And I decided that I'd publish it myself because I didn't think anyone would want a new author. Publishers don't want to hear from new authors. Who gets their first book published at any rate? Mm. So I decided that I would do it my own way. I would produce the book on my computer, take it to a printer, and hope that I would be able to recoup the costs. I had to guess how many or estimate how many I thought I would be able to sell. And that's the way I decided to produce this book. What I did was to write to local newspapers, magazines all around the country and ask if anyone would like to send me their experiences. And I had over 400 replies.
Yeah.
Of those 400, about 250 eventually produced stories. And I made sure that even if they only sent me two or three sentences, that they would all feature in the book. If only cynically thinking if they were in the book, they're going to buy a copy.
Oh, he's clever.
So in the book, if you think about it, it's being very small children. A lot of the children were very, very young. My mum, as I said, mentioned earlier on the radio, she was evacuated, and so was my dad as well. But she came back after a month because her dad came to rescue her.
Yes.
But it must have been for children just the most traumatic thing of standing on a train station with your little box with your gas mask
and a label on your lapel
and being you can't even imagine what it would feel like for a small child to be taken away from their parent at that age.
Yeah. And of course, a lot of the children were told by their parents, oh, it'll only be for a little while, you'll be back in a few weeks. Some were told, oh, you're just going for a day out. And And then they disappeared.
Yeah. For 4 years. Sometimes.
Well, some of them didn't come back because their families were killed or they had, you know, they didn't.
But their experiences were considerably different.
Yeah.
A lot of them say that it taught them to be self-reliant and resilient. And a lot of them had a very good experience because they stayed in stately homes and lived a life of luxury. Two brothers that are that's contributed to the book stayed in a big stately home and had a butler in Dorset to look after them.
Yeah.
And they were even paid a penny a week for weeding the drive. So the experience that there were between 2 and 3 million evacuees.
Yes. Yeah.
The estimates vary considerably because some went with their parents just as evacuees. Others were sort of forced away. So of those 2 million, there are probably 2 million different permutations of their experiences.
Yeah.
Some were welcomed with open arms, and many were just used as cheap labour. They were ill-treated and just regarded as intruders and not wanted.
Right, just coming up to 11:52, I'm joined in the studio by Brian Davies and Sylvia Kent here with this month's book club. Now, before the break, we were talking to Brian about evacuees, and you said there was something called the cattle market. What was that?
Well, all the children, when they reached their destination, were lined up in village halls or even in the street, and people would come along and say, "I'll have that one," or "I'll have that one there." And they found that it was, they said, many people said it was just like a cattle market. One farmer's son said when he heard someone coming along and say, "I want a girl, not a boy," it's just like the cattle markets that he'd attended. And sometimes the billeting officers would go round knocking on doors and say, "Will you take this one?"
Can't imagine that now, can you?
Almost invariably, the pretty girls went first, and the boys were left at last, unless it was a farmer who wanted a bit of help, and he wanted a strong lad to help on the farm.
And obviously they would have sometimes had to split up brother and sister or two brothers, and they would have gone to separate addresses.
That's right,
Or in different parts of the country, probably, as well, depending on where they were sent to.
Yes, or some siblings were parted and didn't see each other for the rest of the war, 5 years, perhaps.
Yeah. Also, you've got here, there was a lot of prejudice against London, because now we've got, it's such an internet world where we've got, we're so multicultural now in the UK. Back, obviously, in the 1930s, you kind of stayed in your village, you died in your village, you never went really outside or travelled abroad or anything like that. And there was quite a lot of prejudice against Londoners from the counties.
There was. One evacuee said that she was told that all Londoners are thieves.
Yeah.
Or they're dirty.
Yeah.
One girl said that she was put in a cold bath outside and scrubbed with the floor brush because they said she was dirty and she had to be clean. One said, "You're just a filthy, dirty Londoner," and we know that all Londoners are thieves. And
what about the food as well? Because I know, obviously there's rationing when did rationing start? Was it right at the beginning or was it halfway through the war? Because it went on quite a lot after the war. It was good for
years after. Yes, there was rationing. And of course, a lot of these children went out to the country and weren't used to the sort of food that was produced. Among the things which were, some mentioned, one had cold cow udder. Another one said he had salt and pepper sandwiches. And one boy was so hungry that he went down in the night at his foster parents' home, got 2 pieces of bread and took the heads off of a vase of daffodils and put them in the sandwich and ate them.
Gosh. Oh, dear.
He was very ill after that.
They did get an allowance, these people, didn't they, that looked after the children. They did
It was 8 and 6 months a week.
8 and 6.
8 and 6 months a week they got.
But depending on whether they wanted to spend it on the children,
Whether it was spent on the children or not is another matter.
Now you've got here, I've got bedding down for the night. Bedding down meant on. You've got here bed coffins. What are bed coffins?
Several of them had unusual beds. One girl had to sleep on a coffin lid because the person that she was evacuated with was an undertaker. And when some people came to stay with the family, they said, well, you can sleep on that coffin lid. So that was her
that
bed.
That was terrifying.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Have you got any sort of cheerful little things that people did enjoy about? Because it sounds really...
He does, actually, yeah, but we can't actually say. Can we, Brian?
Is it a little bit too... Oh, is
some
it
of those funny ones?
Well, there were some very amusing incidents, yeah.
Say a little bit risque. We might just be able to get away with it.
One thing that amuses me was a young girl who... before the evacuation started, she was in church, and the vicar said, probably you children are going to be evacuated, and I expect some of you have even got your cases packed, ready to go. And this girl said, yes, she said, I've got 3 new handkerchiefs and a pair of knickers. She said, at that point, a hand went over my mouth.
A lot of children actually tried to run away as well, didn't they?
Yes, quite a few of them decided they would run away. One young lady managed to travel with her sister all the way from Kettering, a 10-hour journey back home to London. She managed to get on a train. They managed to get on the train, go back to London. When they got back to London, it was discovered they'd run away, and the father was fined £25 for taking her away from school.
Oh, that was a lot of money. That's several hundred pounds.
Yeah.
Absolutely,
yes.
Yeah.
I would say that when Brian sent me the book, he also sent me a list of some of the local people that I know and knew then, including our own Brian Lynch
in the
Gazette.
Yep.
And he had some good memories, didn't he, Brian?
Brian, yes. Brian said, this is another interesting point, that a lot of these townies, they didn't realise that milk came from cows and that apples grew on trees.
Yep.
And Brian Lynch said when he was evacuated all the way up to Lancashire, he saw a herd of cows, and he said it was as if his picture book was coming to life. One boy saw these green things on trees. These green lumps on trees. And he said that he was told they were apples. And he said, no, they can't be. Apples are red and they come from the co-op.
Yeah. Because it just shows you, because they didn't have, I mean, you would have had a very tiny TV if you were lucky, if you were lucky, that was in black and white, so you wouldn't have had the colour. You'd only have gone to the cinema maybe once a week to see the flicks on a Saturday morning, and you would have had the news probably on that cinema reel, so you wouldn't know anything about the outside world.
No.
So for young children to go to the country, it must have been, you know, in the summertime, and being able to run in fields if you're from the middle of London.
Yeah.
Must have been incredible.
Yeah, well, one young lady, she was about 6, and when she got into the country, the person she was billeted with says, well, you can go out in the fields and play. So she went out in the field and saw these round things, what she said, strange round things, which she jumped up and down on to see how many pieces she could get them into. Returned to her billet and said, what are those things that I've been jumping on? And the woman said, those are cowpats. Well, what's a cowpat?